The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt in the West Coast studio of the Salem News Channel. Good Ides of March to you. It's March 15th, 2024. And I am joined from the top and for the entire hour by Dan Senor. Dan is the host of the extraordinary Call Me Back podcast, which you can listen to two or three times a week. He's the author with Saul Singer of two books that are important to you. The Genius of Israel came out recently, The Surprising Resilience of a Divided Nation in a Turbulent World, and the other book, Startup Nation. First of all, Dan, thanks for your books. Thanks for the introduction to Haviv Redinger. Thank you for Call Me Back, and thank you especially, well, for all of that, but also Daniel Gordis and his Israel, the Story of a Nation Reborn, History of Zionism. I've read three times since you recommended it to me, listened to it twice and read it once, because it's such an extraordinary summary of so much I didn't know, because I only know really the Jewish story post-1945 and the American Jewish story post-1974 when I start to meet Jewish people at school. So, Dan, you've been doing yeoman's work, but I wanted to spend an hour with you, especially after listening to your Call Me Back podcast with Haviv. Your title was My Come to Jesus Moment with Haviv Redinger, in which Haviv says, if Sinwar can say we are still standing, he will say that Israel cannot even destroy Hamas, the weakest of Israel's enemies. The ramifications, Israeli deterrence, are catastrophic. Matter of time before Israelis leave and sail away like the Crusaders. That's what Hamas would say. So, Dan, the bottom line, the first question, we'll come back around. Is President Biden, has Secretary Schumer thrown Israel under the bus?
I don't think from a pure policy standpoint, Hugh, and as you know, in our last episode, the one you're citing with Haviv Redinger, Haviv and I, who are very close personally and usually see events similarly, we typically, you know, share the same analysis. The first time we got into kind of a little bit of a heated, respectful but heated disagreement, because we both have been of the view that what President Biden has done for Israel post October 7th was extremely important and supportive. And I think it's important just to rattle off a few of those things, right? One, he made a very powerful statement right after October 7th in support of Israel. He made it clear which side he was on a number of ways, not the least of which is he flew to Israel, sat with the war cabinet, you know, most powerful leader in the world, the man who leads the commander-in-chief of the most powerful military in the world. Goes to Israel, deploys military assets to the Eastern Mediterranean, sending a signal to Hezbollah, gets munitions going to Israel on a pretty steady clip, which was impressive because of the dysfunction in Congress and the White House worked around it. And he gave Israel diplomatic cover at the UN, vetoing bad UN resolutions. He deserves credit for all those things. Haviv and I, in our podcast every week, had been basically saying that. Where I took issue with Haviv is he believed that if Biden at some point has to ding Israel rhetorically, not substantively, but ding them rhetorically to pander to his base, as Haviv would say, if he's got to do some things to win Michigan at Israel's expense, we can handle it. And I was willing to not protest Haviv's take. I was sort of along for the ride. I saw what President Biden did at the State of the Union address and the criticisms, unprecedented for him or for any president for that matter, the criticisms he made against Israel were to me over the top, to use his phrase, and unfair and very damaging. And then a couple of interviews that Vice President Harris did over the subsequent days, and even an interview the president did. And my argument to Aviv was, it is true that at a substantive level, the president has been doing the right thing on the policy front. But rhetoric has consequences. And when you unleash the kind of criticisms against Israel that Biden was doing, it provides jet fuel, rocket fuel, for Israel's critics, for Israel's opponents, to include the UN, to include many capitals throughout Europe, to include many countries in the broader Arab Muslim world, to include the media. And not that those they were holding back, but Biden validated their criticisms. And so if there is a pylon on Israel, President Biden added to it, contributed to it. He provided rocket fuel for it with the things he said. And I'm happy to go through the things he said in our podcast episode. We literally chronicle some of the most damaging.
We're going to do that, too. I've got the President tape. Biden said, I brought the receipts I want you to be able to respond.
Yeah. And I thought it was outrageous.
It is outrageous. And then Chuck Schumer yesterday, we'll come to this. The hubristic moment of the millennium is when Chuck Schumer stands up in the well of the Senate and tells Bibi Netanyahu that he's the problem. I actually don't have a precedent for this in American history. I don't think we've ever, maybe the appeal to King George that was filed before the Declaration of Independence, but it just, the idea that our majority leader in the Senate would lecture a democratically elected leader of our ally who's been invaded, savaged, pilloried, and has hostages is astonishing. And the fact that the president didn't mention anti-Semitism in America and stated all of that. But I want to get to my bottom line and test it on you. This is a political calculation that they do have weakness on their left. I think you and Haviv and I agree on that. But I believe it's gone so far now that he is going to suffer loss of his Jewish American voters and his Friends of Allies voters. And I want people to know the numbers. In 2000, Al Gore got 79% of the Jewish American vote. In 2004, John Kerry got 76%. In 2008, President Obama got 78%. In 2012, that dropped to 69% for President Obama. It went back up for Hillary Clinton to 71% in 2016. And in 2020, Joe Biden only got 68% of the American Jewish vote in the general election. I think he is putting a lot of that 68% at risk, Dan. I really do, because American Jews are afraid right now. They actually feel fear. I'm 68. I'm older than you. All of my Harvard buddies who are Jewish that I lived with for 4 years, we've talked about this. They can't believe what they see at our alma mater. And I believe this will have, unless he changes course in a hurry and gets back to saying, we stand with Israel, we will supply Israel, Hamas must be destroyed, he's going to hemorrhage Jewish American votes and Friends of Israel votes. What do you think?
So, I agree, and I know it because I'm already hearing it. And as you said, you're hearing it from your buddies from Harvard. I am hearing it from friends of mine. I live in New York City. Let's just say I have a lot of very liberal Jewish friends in New York. And what more and more of them are saying to me now, and by the way, I'm not suggesting for a moment that Biden's going to lose New York in 2024, but it's representative of where the Jewish community is nationally. What I friends tell me is, well, maybe I'll just sit it out. Maybe I just won't vote, which is in and of itself extraordinary. And then they're even open to voting for Trump, which I just never thought I would see in a million years. Look, to me, the state to watch, which is the most interesting, is Pennsylvania.
Yes, Philly suburbs.
Pennsylvania is interesting. Right, Philly suburbs. So you can't win, Biden can't win Pennsylvania without the Philly suburbs, and you can't win the Philly suburbs if you have not consolidated the Jewish vote, because the Philly suburbs are largely populated by Jewish
home to many American Jews. Home as Pittsburgh, not as big as Philly, but Pittsburgh.
Right. So you can't win Pennsylvania without the suburbs, and you cannot win. Biden can't win the presidency without Pennsylvania. If he loses Pennsylvania, he's going to lose. So let's look at other Democratic leaders in Pennsylvania and what they've been doing. And the ones I point to are John Fetterman and Josh Shapiro. Now, regardless of what one may think of those two, the governor of Pennsylvania and the junior senator of Pennsylvania on other issues, they are both trying to chart a course that is independent from the progressive base of the party, of the Democratic Party, specifically John Fetterman. What issues is he most vocal on these days? He's most vocal on being "quote unquote," tough on crime. He's very critical of the administration's policies that have thus far that have gotten this migrant crisis going at the rate it's going. And what else has John Fetterman done?
He is pro Israel.
Been an outspoken pro Israel, and not only pro Israel, Hugh, but makes a point of sticking it to the progressive left. He's so annoyed with the progressive left that he kind of revels in his criticism.
He's winning Republican friends. I got to go to break. We're going to talk to Dan between the radio segments off air. I'll put it all in the podcast today. We'll talk about Josh Shapiro during the break. He is, I think, the most talented Democrat holding elected office in the United States. Scares me as a Republican, but we'll do that during the break. We'll be back with Dan Senor, host of Call Me Back podcast, right after this. Welcome back. Dan Senor is my guest, host of the Call Me Back podcast. You should follow it. You should absolutely give it 5 stars. Rate it. It is indispensable. It's where I learned about Haviv Redinger and Amanda Dan and all these other wonderful podcasters from Israel. There's really only 4 sources of information. You can talk to Israelis. You can talk to American Israelis. You can talk to American Jews who know what they're talking about. And then you can talk to friends of Israel like me. Or you could talk to people who hate Israel, but I'm not spending any time on that. Dan, during this short break, Josh Shapiro is the governor of Pennsylvania. He's a friend of mine. I think he is the most talented Democrat in America. And if I were a Republican, I would be afraid that he would be somehow ending up on a ticket with Gavin Newsom or somebody else as the vice president to lock down Pennsylvania. He's a very impressive guy. I have not followed what he said about this hostage crisis and this war. What has he said?
Well, where he has made his mark, so on certain issues in Pennsylvania, I'm not with him on everything, but he's been more moderate than more most of the party is. But
yes,
where he's been incredibly, I think, important is speaking out against anti-Semitism on American college campuses. Because
yes,
you remember one of the first battlegrounds was the University of Pennsylvania. And Liz McGill, who was the president of Pennsylvania, of Penn, who was on that congressional, that House panel with the president of Harvard and the president of MIT. And Shapiro has been speaking out about anti-Semitism is a real issue, which I believe also our president should be doing. And so my only point to you is that I think those two guys are examples of a way Democrats could and should govern and lead on issues that matter. And the reason I say this, think this is important, is because President Biden being so critical of Israel right now has, as I said, it validates the pile-on against Israel. But I also think it's a proxy for a sense of disorder right now in America, right? These protesters against Israel, right? They're blocking bridges, they're blocking highways to airports, they're protesting in front of hospitals, they are causing chaos. And I don't care, you may not be, a majority of Americans are pro-Israel, but it's not even about that. You don't have to be engaged in Israel to find this disruption in daily American life to be outrageous. And I think President Biden, you asked me, do I think President Biden runs the risk of losing a state like Pennsylvania because of this, if he panders too much to the left on Israel? Yes, I do. But not just because of Jewish voters. I also think there are other voters who aren't Jewish who, like I said, may be sympathetic to Israel, but that's not a top three issue for them. But they watch what's happening. And they say, who are these anti-Israel protesters, and why are they causing such disorder in our country? And we are against what they are doing.
Dan, I want to stress, I listen to Call Me Back Pod, and I listen to all of my Jewish American friends and all of the Israeli media sources. But I think there are a considerable number of voters in America who are in the middle or on the center right, like I am, or on the center left, as some of my friends in the Democratic Party are, for whom the allyship with Israel matters quite a deal. I don't think we should underestimate how many people are not Jewish for whom this is the number one issue. Do you want to put a percentage on that of the electorate? I'm going to guess it's at least 5% of the electorate.
Well, I'll tell you one here that blew me away. I was with a number of Senate Republicans, Republican senators, 2 days ago in Washington, talking to them about Israel and what's happening in Israel and the Middle East. And I made this point. I made the point I'm making to you right now, that this is an issue that matters not just to American Jews. And one of the senators, I won't say his name, said to me after, he said, you know, it's funny that you say that. We polled, our campaign polled 20 or 30 issues against our opponent, Democratic opponent, to get a sense of which issues, which criticisms of our opponent resonated the most. And he said, we want to find the top three issues. And he said concerns about the rise in anti-Semitism was among the top three.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back with Dan Senor. Welcome back, America. Dan Senor, host of Call Me Back podcast, is my guest. He was just talking about a conversation he had with some Republican senators. I've had the same one. I talked to a lot of senators, and they have told me their polling is that Israel's war in Gaza is a top three issue. And I'm not surprised because it's a proxy issue. Two nights ago, George W. Bush was at the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda, and the president was off the record, but I can count. I think I can say this without giving away any confidences. Israel is the most dangerous nation in the world today, according to W. And I believe Americans know that. And I believe they know that we've got Americans held hostage and the president doesn't name them. And he doesn't name the Abbey Gate victims. He doesn't name the three Jordanian soldiers who were killed over there. We're not stupid. We all see the world and Iran is moving chess pieces around and we don't know what's going on. We're actually dumbfounded by this.
Yeah, I think that I think President Bush, it sounds like I agree with him. This point about hostages is interesting to me. So Bill McGurn with The Wall Street Journal, the columnist for The Wall Street Journal, wrote a very good column on the Monday before President Biden's, or maybe it was the Tuesday before President Biden's State of the Union address, in which he said, why don't Americans know the names of the Americans, of their fellow citizens who are being held in tunnels under Gaza hostage? Why aren't they household names? And he was right. I hadn't really thought about it. I spoke to Bill when he was working on that piece. I connected him actually to a couple of hostage families, American families who have children being held in Gaza. Tragically, one of them was just the parents just found out that he was dead. Itai Chen, who was he was in a tank in southern Gaza. He was pulled out of the tank, taken hostage, and they now know he was killed. They're originally from Long Island, and they when Brittany Griner was taken, you know, by Putin, every American knew who Brittany Griner's name, President Biden, the
ASAP Rocky. ASAP Rocky was right. Held in Sweden, right. And Ambassador O'Brien was then the SPIHA, Special Presidential Envoy in Hostage Affairs, a good friend of mine. And we found out about ASAP Rocky all the time. We knew the name of every hostage, and we haven't heard one name. There has been a Fox News story on each of the five that are thought to be alive, but it's not. It's neither across the president's lips.
Right. And so, and by the way, what happened at the State of the Union is the families of the American hostages were there in the chamber, but they were invited there not by the president. They were invited there by members of Congress. Lindsey Graham brought the Chen family, the parents, it was bipartisan. Some Republicans, some Democrats brought these Americans, and that forced the president's hand. I'm not sure President Biden would have, at least he didn't mention their names. At least he mentioned that there were Americans being held. I'm not sure he would have had the parents not been in the chamber. And the only reasons the parents were in the chamber was because members of Congress brought them there.
Let me play for you a cut from that State of the Union. Cut 17, please, for Dan Senor, host of Call Me Back Pod.
And Israel must do its part. Israel must allow more aid into Gaza to ensure humanitarian workers aren't caught in the crossfire. And they're announcing they're going to have a crossing in northern Gaza. For the leadership of Israel, I say this. Humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration.
Stop.
Or a bargaining chip.
Dan Senor, that is an insult. Israel has never used humanitarian aid as leverage. And I can't believe that line got into the speech. And Haviv mentioned to you, maybe he just has bad speechwriters. I've done a lot of bad speechwriters. What you should have said is a presidential speech goes through about 50 pairs of hands. Everybody sees what's in it. Not a mistake.
I said to Haviv, I've been involved with this process. The number of eyes on a presidential speech is just staff, cabinet secretaries that work on the issues that are addressed in the speech draft. I mean, it's just endless the number of people see it. There's no errors are extremely rare in a State of the Union address. Or at least factual errors. That was a glaring factual error.
It was an attack.
Not only glaring.
It was an attack on Israel.
But here's the thing. If you want to say Israel's record of delivering humanitarian aid to the Palestinians is uneven, that's fine. Because it's hard. It's complicated. But it's not a decision Israel's making. It's not a strategic decision Israel's making to like some kind of collective punishment of civilians.
I'm surprised you didn't use the term Shylock and use some other trope from the Protocols of the Elder of Zion. It was really an anti-Israel moment. I'll be right back with Dan Senor. We'll talk during the break. We've got four more segments with Dan. Host of Call Me Back Pod. You should subscribe and follow that and give 5 stars and a review. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. I'm talking with Dan Senor. Dan, you know the old adage, that which gets rewarded gets repeated. Today, as we talk, Hamas has offered to release some Israeli hostages in exchange for 1,000 prisoners, including many terrorists who are serving life sentences. And there's a demand for the complete Israeli withdrawal mixed in there. I think they are acting rationally as evil people, realizing that Joe Biden has got round heels. What do you think? I think Hamas is just reacting to the fact they're cornered. They're dead unless they get the West to make Israel back off.
Yeah, they've got, I mean, Defense Minister Gallant, who I know, who's a quite extraordinary and impressive figure, early in the war, had the theory inside the War Council in Israel that the best way to get the hostages back, everyone wants the hostages back, the best way to get the hostages back is to pound Hamas militarily, hit them hard. If they feel like they are under siege and that Israel is not going to be tentative in its response, the only defense they have is trying to get Israel to pull back by releasing hostages. And so, by November, they had the first hostage deal. So I think his strategy has borne out. And I think the only reason, I think this last month has been frustrating because I think Sinwar and the Hamas leadership have been playing the West by dragging things out with these negotiations that haven't gone anywhere because they were concerned that Israel's about to go into Rafah, which I think they are. And that's where the most fierce four battalions of Hamas are based. And it is where Sinwar and the leadership of Hamas are based. They do not want Israel coming into Rafah. So they've been dragging out these hostage negotiations in the hope that they could head off an Israel advance into Rafah. I think they also wanted to avoid it happening during Ramadan, be that as it may. I think up until now, the only progress Israel has been able to achieve has been when they've been putting military pressure on Israel, not when the U.S. and international institutions have been telling Israel to cool off.
When they've been putting military pressure on Hamas? That's when it works, is when they kill Hamas people.
Yeah, that's my point. When Israel is putting military pressure on Hamas and advancing, and when Hamas believes, oh my gosh, they're coming, they're moving forward, they went to Khan Yunis, you know, they went to the north, then they went to Khan Yunis, and now they're going into Rafah. They're not stopping. When Hamas believes that is the trajectory and the momentum, that is when they want to negotiate. When President Biden and others are criticizing Israel and telling Israel to hold back and telling Israel to rethink its advance into Rafah, That's when they're not so interested in negotiating.
I'm going to ask you this on the other side as well, but I fear we're coming up on a Munich moment. And by that, I mean a moment at which Joe Biden surrenders to Sinwar's demands and threatens Israel effectively so that they are allowed to remain in Rafah. Do you fear that happening, Dan Senor? And we've got about 30 seconds till we go back on the radio show across the country.
Yeah, Hugh, I am. I'm really, really concerned. And these next few weeks are key. And I think that I think there's a good chance that Israel is going to advance during Ramadan.
I think they should. Otherwise, you're going to end up with that. Chuck Schumer was a flare. That was not an uncoordinated speech. Do you agree with me? The White House knew what Schumer was going to do.
I believe the White House asked Schumer to do.
Right. Okay. We do agree.
I don't think Chuck Schumer came up with this on his own. I think it was completely coordinated and requested by the administration. We can talk a lot about that. I have a lot of thoughts on what Schumer did. I thought what Schumer did was really damaging.
Yeah.
Fortunately, he's now backtracking.
Well, he'd better, or he's going to lose New York. I mean, there's one way for Chuck Schumer to lose New York, and it's to lose his Jewish supporters, and there are a lot of them. And I'm so stunned by that speech. We'll talk about it on the other side. If people do not know it, yesterday, a member of the United States Senate, an elected official, yes, and he matters a lot in the United States, yes, but he has no standing abroad. He has absolutely no diplomatic or national security chops, presumed to tell Israel what it needed to do, that it needed to change governments. We never tell this to Bashar Assad. We never tell Putin this. We wouldn't dare tell Xi this. But we tell Benjamin Netanyahu's freely elected government, it's got to go. Stand by, America. I'll be right back with Dan Senor. Want to remind everyone, a great sponsor of the program is MyPhDWeightLoss.com. Generalissimo went on that program more than a year ago, lost 50 pounds. He's kept it off. And stress eating is not allowed, I don't believe, even though we're under a lot of...
You're tempted to this week, aren't we?
Everybody is. But we don't... I'm sure they give you tricks of the trade to combat that, because that's one of the habits. You broke that habit. You're not going by Del Taco or Taco Bell.
Have not. No.
You haven't relapsed.
Have not relapsed.
And that is and it's healthy, it's wise, it's productive.
864-644-1900.
That's
864-644-1900.
What is your red line with Prime Minister Netanyahu? Do you have a red line? For instance, would invasion of Rafah, which you have urged him not to do, would that be a red line?
It is a red line, but I'm never going to leave Israel. The defense of Israel is still critical. So there's no red line. I'm going to cut off all weapons so they don't have the Iron Dome to protect them. They don't have. But there's red lines that if he crosses, and he cannot have 30,000 more Palestinians dead as a consequence of going out. There's other ways to deal with the trauma caused by Hamas. And it's like the first time I went over, I sat with them and I sat with a war captain. I said, look, don't make the mistake America made. America made a mistake. We went after bin Laden until we got him. But we shouldn't have gone into Ukraine. I mean, we shouldn't have gone into the whole thing in Iraq and Afghanistan. It wasn't necessary.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I could teach a seminar on the 1 minute and 6 seconds with Jonathan Capehart, my colleague from The Washington Post. Dan, we have never imposed a red line on an ally, much less an ally that is fighting a war of survival, not an existential war anymore, but the existential war is coming with Hezbollah. What do you make of this, and why would Chuck Schumer agree to do what he did as their cat's paw?
There's so much to unpack there. First of all, I don't even know what he was talking about, a red line. He didn't even talk about what exactly the red line is, going into Rafah or going into Rafah in a way that the administration doesn't want Israel to go into Rafah. What is it? What is the consequence of the red line? I mean, it was so garbled. I honestly don't even know what he was talking about. A. B. Soon before Israel launched its ground invasion, senior military officers from the U.S. were asked by the administration to go brief the Israeli War Council and warn them, based on the U.S. experience in Iraq and Afghanistan, how difficult counterinsurgency fighting is and let them know you're going to have a lot of casualties. Is it really worth it? A version of what he was saying right there. And the from what I understand, the estimates that were provided to Israel would have resulted in 10 times the casualties that Israel has experienced in Gaza so far. Now, it's not to say that the casualties in Gaza are awful. Every one of those lives are heroes, and it's a tragedy. But I got to tell you, Hugh, the numbers are a lot lower, and obviously these things can change, so I don't want to sound too overconfident or cavalier about this, but the numbers are a lot lower than the U.S. had forecast. Like I said, 10% of what the U.S. said the casualties will be. So I don't even know what – so he's wrong about comparing the Israeli experience to the U.S. experience in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we can have a whole separate debate about whether he was right about Iraq or at least about Afghanistan. As for Chuck Schumer, look, I thought what Schumer said was I'm perplexed by it. I rarely hear Chuck Schumer weighing in on a foreign policy matter. I rarely hear him call. I don't think I've ever heard him, and I'm happy to be corrected. I've never heard him call for a change of government in any country.
I agree. I don't think so.
Or Democrat.
I don't think so.
And here's the most, even if he were, he has such a problem with the policy and not Netanyahu, because keep in mind, Netanyahu is a divisive figure in Israeli politics. Netanyahu is an unpopular leader today in Israeli politics, but his policies aren't. His policy in Gaza, his policy in taking on Hamas is the policy of the war cabinet. The war cabinet includes not only the prime minister, but it includes his chief political opponent, Benny Gantz. Benny Gantz right now is polling way higher than Netanyahu. If an election were held today, Benny Gantz would be able to form a very strong majority coalition government. The combination of Netanyahu's seats and where Gantz is polling represents the overwhelming majority of the country, of Israel, from right to left. There is a right-left consensus on what needs to be done in Gaza, and they are represent that consensus is represented by the support of Netanyahu and Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot and others. And so what's Schumer complaining about? Schumer says Netanyahu's the problem. It sounds like they have a problem with the policy, not with Netanyahu, but they don't want to say that. So
they are engaged in campaign 2024. The purpose of this hour is for me to test my theory on you that this is all about campaign 2024. They are worried about a few percentages of votes in seven swing states, but they have no idea. We can also, two things can be true. They're worried about losing 2024 and the campaign is run by stupid people. Because we sometimes think that campaign people are wizards, and sometimes they turn out not to be wizards. They turn out to be, my friend Stuart Stevens botched the 2000 and 2012 campaign, just botched it completely. And you go back to Bob Beckel in 1984, and he made jokes about it. People can botch a campaign. They're botching this campaign, Dan. And I want to ask you, do you think the American Jewish community and its friends, like Irish Catholic Zionists like me, which is a funny way to say it, but it's true, should we all go back to the mall to remind them that 300,000 people can show up on 3 days' notice?
Yeah. Look, I don't quite understand the campaign strategy, the Biden campaign strategy, because they are so, I think, overly concerned about this progressive base, this pandering base, this uncommitted vote that showed, quote unquote, showed up in Michigan for the primary, which I think they're overreacting to, because A, as a percentage of the Democratic vote that turned out in Michigan, it was about the same as the non-committed, quote unquote, non-committed vote that showed up for President Obama. So it wasn't way off.
It was worse in Minnesota and Washington State. It was 20% in Minnesota and 20% in Washington State did not vote for Biden.
But either way, Hugh, these are votes. These are protest votes without consequence.
Agree.
So it's easy if someone wants to register a statement and say, all right, I'm going to make a statement. I want to send a message that I don't like President Biden's policy on Israel and Hamas. So I'm going to vote non-committal, non-committed. Fine. Go ahead. Do it. Like Zeigesund, as we say in Yiddish, like have at it. All right. But in November, They're not going to do that. Do you know why? Because they think, well, if I do it then, I get Donald Trump as president.
Yeah.
In other words, a protest vote in November has consequences.
But there's a point. It's hard to imagine, but there's a point where they're going to convert Democrats into Trump voters, Dan. And they're getting very close to that point. I didn't think it would be possible. I thought it would be a turnout election and that, you know, base against base 2004 all over again. But this is unprecedented. And I want to ask you, you're a smart guy, and you ran the Coalition Provisional Authority. Did we drop supplies into Mosul when we were pounding? You're the spokesperson for the head of the Provisional Authority. Did we drop supplies into Mosul? Did we ever think about the German innocence in March of 1945? Did we drop supplies into Tokyo after we burned it to the ground? We've never done this before. Hamas is an evil actor. They have to be defeated. And I believe in unconditional surrender when you've got evil actors who kill 1,200 people on a bright, sunny day at a music rave and an associated kibbutz. This is not someone with whom you negotiate. It's not Napoleon. It's not the Great League. It's evil.
Yeah, I couldn't believe in the State of the Union that President Biden put the quote-unquote priority of delivering humanitarian assistance on the same plane as defeating Hamas, as though those were equal objectives of the war. No, they're not equal objectives. The objective of the war is for Israel to win this defensive war. It is a defensive war that Israel's fighting. October 6th, there was a ceasefire. October 7th, the ceasefire was broken. Why was it broken? Because Hamas launched a war. What happens in war? There is violence. When there's violence in war, do innocent civilians get killed? Yes. In a war in which the enemy uses civilians as a shield and it hides under 300 miles of tunnels underground while their civilians are above ground, are more civilians going to get killed? Yes. Does it create a disastrous humanitarian situation, a human catastrophe? Yes. Whose fault is that? Hamas. The pressure should be put on Hamas. Should not be put on Israel.
The message that I would like to have given by the president, I want to hear how you would frame it. You're very good at messaging. We are 100% behind Israel. We will give them everything they need to wage a war that is far beyond anything required by the law of armed conflict. We praise Israel for their restraint. We will give them everything until Hamas is destroyed and Sinwar accepted or arrested, dead, or in exile. And that's our only message. And we're not going to change that message. And in public, across every platform, every Democrat ought to say that. That's unconditional surrender, Grant, and it works, Dan. Do you think the Democrats have thought about that?
I think some have. I think John Fetterman has. I think some other Democrats I know have. My friend Dave McCormick, who's running for the U.S. Senate in Pennsylvania against Bob Casey, I think to myself, if McCormick is in the Senate and Fetterman is in the Senate, you'll have the most pro-Israel duo, bipartisan duo, of any state in the U.S. Senate.
It'll be hard to match Maine. Model. Angus and Susan Collins are both very strong Israeli supporters. I think Maine's got the best Senate delegation right now.
That may be. But my only point is, I think that the position you just laid out, that this is Hamas's problem, Hamas created this mess, and only Hamas can end the mess, and the pressure's on Hamas. There's a human catastrophe in Gaza right now because of Hamas. And the Hamas is responsible for the massacre of Israeli civilians, and it is responsible for the deaths of Palestinian civilians. If you want to end civilian deaths, you need to pressure Hamas, full stop.
It was
the
chilling.
Idea that President Biden or Chuck Schumer are saying anything otherwise. I mean, even in Schumer's speech, he listed out the obstacles to getting some kind of peace in the region. And he listed Hamas and Benjamin Netanyahu in the same, like as though they were of equal import. It was insane. Israel has a democracy. They're about a year and change into the first term, if you will, of this new parliament, this new government, this new Netanyahu-led government. What they won a decisive majority, this new government in Israel. So you don't like Netanyahu? So you just you say, okay, now the Senate, a senator from the Senate floor can announce, oh yeah, that country over there. Yeah. Oh, by the way, one of our most important allies.
Who would have had on there, their bingo card? Who would have said on 10-8 that the answer is regime change in Israel? Because that's what President Biden said. I'll be right back with Dan Senor during the break. We have one more on-air and two more off-air segments. So get it all on my podcast, Highly Concentrated. You go sign up right now for the Call Me Back podcast, which is actually indispensable. One more thing. Don't forget our friends at Alliance Defending Freedom. Alliance Defending Freedom saves your freedoms from lefties in court. And Harrigan and his buddies fight the wars. But you can help Alliance Defending Freedom today by making a contribution at the website at HughHewitt.com. Wait one beat, two beat, and the banner appears at the top. Keep them in the game. I know you've been planning on doing, you've been thinking, I can do 10, I can do 20, I can do $25, maybe do 100. Whatever you can do, please go right now to QQIT.com and make that donation. I am back with Dan Senor, host of the Call Me Back podcast. Dan, I want to focus on something during this 5 minutes off the air. American Jews are afraid. And Haviv told me that during his tour campus at my alma mater, the demonstrators weren't aimed at him. They were aimed at making the American Jewish students at Harvard Law School auditorium afraid. They are winning in this regard in London, and they, by meaning the Hamas supporters, are winning in America. The president hasn't spoken out about this. This is shameful. How do you react, not as an American Jew, but as an American, you know, whose friends are being threatened and our president doesn't say anything?
I think it's shameful. I think that where this is going, on my podcast, John Podhortz and I had a long conversation about 2 months ago called the end of a Jewish golden age, where we kind of laid out how we got to this moment where there's been this dramatic rise. You look at the FBI data, you look at the ADL data, you know, 300, 400, 500%, depending on how you measure it, in terms of rise in anti-Semitic incidents since October 7th. You don't need the data to know it. You see it. I see it. I live it. I am very involved in organized Jewish life in the United States. My kids go to a Jewish day school. We're involved with our synagogue. You feel it everywhere. People are scared. And where this is going, as Haviv pointed out, where this is going is what they're trying to do is drive Jews underground. Because they're not just attacking people for their support of Israel. They're not just attacking Jews for their support of Israel. They're attacking Jews for being Jewish.
Yes.
When they're vandalizing and protesting in front of Starbucks stores. Why? Why are they protesting in front of Starbucks stores? Because the CEO of Starbucks is Howard Schultz. He's Jewish. I've never once heard Howard Schultz say a thing about Israel. But somehow they're attacking his stores. In Canada, my friend Heather Reisman, who's the CEO of Indigo Books, which is like the Barnes & Noble of Canada, she's Jewish. They, on the 85th anniversary of Kristallnacht last November, about four to six weeks after October 7th, they completely vandalized her store. They put posters up on the windows calling her chief genocide officer. Why? Because she's Jewish. This really is like what was happening in the 1920s and 1930s in Germany. I'm not saying that's where we're heading in terms of where that things went ultimately there. But
we're there. When Jews are afraid to wear their head coverings, and I never speak Hebrew and I never name anything because I get the pronunciation all wrong. When they're afraid to be Jews in public, we've crossed a red line in America that I am 68. I've never, ever imagined we would get to this place right now.
Yeah. So I've never seen, by the way, I've consciously, you know, been very attached to and aware of and in touch with my Jewish identity for most of my life. I have never, Hugh, felt this sort of visceral. My mother's a Holocaust survivor, and when I was a kid, I remember her always, she was on the run as a kid, and so when I was a kid, I always remember her always being concerned and always having this, and I understood intellectually how she felt, but at an emotional and visceral level, I never felt what she felt, because where we live, everything was fine. I now this is different. This moment
is very different. We're going to come right back on the air with Dan Senor. I want to remind everyone who's listening to my podcast, where you're hearing Dan, his podcast, Call Me Back, is indispensable. Go sign up for it. Welcome back, America. I have two more segments with Dan Senor, this one and then one off the air, which I'll be up at Highly Concentrated Hewitt, wherever podcasts are found. Dan, we only have one carrier in the Med. We started with two. Do you think Joe Biden has indicated to Hezbollah and Iran that we will, in fact, side with Israel if they force a war in the north? And they're going to. It looks to me like they're going to force Israel to do a conventional first strike, 1967 style, get in there and try and stop these very deadly rockets from hitting Dimona and many other places. Do you think America will come in? And is there reason for Sinwar and Iran to doubt that right now?
I don't know. I think the administration has done a very good job up to this point in terms of, I'm not up to this point, in the first few weeks, by deploying those assets. I think they sent a very strong message to Hezbollah. My concern is the Houthis have been unrestrained and undeterred. I'm trying to understand why. And I'm increasingly of the view that Iran believes it can use its proxies to attack the United States and Israel. And as long as the United States and Israel are responding by attacking or hitting Iran's proxies, everything's fine from Iran's perspective. The fear Iran has is if the U.S. or Israel starts hitting Iran back directly. So far, we have not seen that, or not that we know of. But as long as they can light up their proxies to hit the West, and the West responds by hitting the proxies, Iran doesn't care about what happens to these proxies, all is good in the world from Iran's perspective. So I don't think you can really shake things up, whether it's two carriers or one carrier. To me, it's less about the volume of what you have there than what's the strategy.
And well, let's go there, Dan. I think the CCP is our number one strategic threat, Russia number two for a variety of reasons. There are some second-tier threats like North Korea and Cuba and Venezuela. But Iran is run by theocratic fanatics, and Khamenei is 85, and he may want the hidden imam out of the well. And when I say that, I'm not joking. These are religious fanatics. Do you worry that Khamenei has decided, I'm going out pretty soon, and I'm taking Israel with me? Because it does seem to me that Americans don't understand Shia versus Sunni theology. And it's a big difference. Bernard Lewis used to stress this. It's a huge difference about end times and eschatology.
You know, I've gone back and forth on this. The difference between the threat that the U.S. and Israel face in Iran relative to the threat, say, from the Soviet Union is as much as the Soviet Union was an evil empire, it did not have this messianic viewpoint that it was willing to risk destroying itself in order to achieve its aims. And I can't say the same about Iran. And so that does make me nervous because I think Iran may not be a rational actor. It's not so much that Khamenei is saying, I'm going to do this before I leave my perch. It could be that whether I'm in the seat or not, I'm willing to risk it all for this messianic dream of cleansing the Middle East and the Persian Gulf of Jews. And once you're willing to do that and risk the survival of your own regime, you're willing to do anything.
Habib stunned me because I didn't think anyone would be this inhumane, but I should have remembered Biafra in Nigeria. Sinwar doesn't mind if the Gazans starve. He does not he wants a mass starvation event. And Habib drove this home, and I hadn't thought about it.
It's an advantage. It's an advantage for Sinwar. Look, we did a Hugh, one of my podcast episodes was with a guy named Mati Friedman, someone I highly recommend. He was a journalist for the AP, for the Associated Press, up until 2013, 2014. He covered Gaza for the Associated Press. He lives in Israel, grew up in Canada, made Aliyah, became a citizen of Israel, served in the Israeli army, fought in Lebanon, He then became a journalist. He's a very talented writer, covered Gaza. And what he learned is how Hamas completely manipulates the world, that Hamas can do whatever it does to Israel. Israel responds. And as long as Hamas can make sure that Palestinians, civilians get slaughtered in the crossfire of Israel's response, Hamas can tell the world, oh, look what Israel's doing. It's overreacting. It's not. Its response is not proportional. And then it unleashes the international forces, international diplomatic forces, really, to pressure Israel to pull back. And Israel pulls back, and Hamas gets away, therefore, with their initial strike. So we all said, me included, that on October 7th, Hamas has gone too far. Hamas is what this attack was way too ghoulish and unfathomable, and it won't be accepted. Talk about a red line. This will be the red line. They've gone too far. It's way too brazen. They filmed the whole thing. They telegraphed it to the. This is over the top. And it turns out what Mati Friedman argued on my podcast is, no, Hamas was right. They fooled the world again because the same thing is happening.
They have thus far, but I think the pushback is occurring in real time. I have one more segment with Dan. The useful idiots in the American media are beginning to wake up to this, I think. I'll talk about with that. But Dan, make sure you subscribe to the Call Me Back podcast. Ben Dominic joins me next hour on the Hugh Hewitt Show, but I've got one more segment with Dan. Do not forget, go get Call Me Back, sign up for it, rate it, send it to all your friends. Indispensable. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Dan, this is our last segment for a while. I want to talk about the useful idiots in the American media. I have had to turn down two trips to Israel because they were one-week trips, and I can't do a radio show. I got to find a place that will host me for 4 weeks, and I'll broadcast from Israel every day and bring it, because the American media is falling down.
You've got to do that, Hugh. That would be amazing.
Yeah, I'll talk to you and Oren about it offline. I want to put the show there for a month.
We'll help you with that.
All right. So tell me something, though. Is anyone getting this right, in your view, in the American media? Let's also throw some roses as well as stones. But I don't have any roses no one is covering this the correct way. Except you. And Commentary Pod.
Thank you. Commentary Pod is great. I'll tell you, Hugh, this is interesting. I was in London a couple months ago with Haviv. And I was meeting with I won't say who, but let's just say a senior diplomat from the Arab world, from the Persian Gulf, who happened to be in London when I was there and asked to meet. And he said to me, and he listens to the podcast regularly, to my podcast, to Call Me Back. And he said, and I was surprised by this. I was like, really? He wanted to meet based on some of the conversations of the podcast. So we had a nice long conversation. He's very supportive of normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel, wants Israel fully integrated into the Middle East, has no patience for Hamas. And he said, I said, just out of curiosity, why do you listen to my podcast? He said, because it's the only way I can hear the conversation happening inside Israel.
Yes.
In other words, American press characterized what Israel's doing, but I don't get to hear these different voices, these different journalists, some center right, some from center left, whether it's Haviv who veers more right, or someone like Benny Morris, or Nadav Ayel who veers more left or center left. He says, I don't get to hear all these voices inside Israel. He goes, I didn't realize there's this whole discussion inside Israel and this whole vibrant debate. And he goes, and I didn't realize, even though these people have such personal animus for their political leaders, and many of these political leaders have personal animus for one another, but there's such a strong consensus on the policy.
And that's why I didn't realize it. So what I'm trying to do, and Times of Israel, I also listened to Yossi and Daniel Hartman and the Hartman Institute. Here's where I want to close, Dan. You'll know the name Breckinridge Long. He was a State Department bureaucrat, third Assistant Secretary of State under Woodrow Wilson, Assistant Secretary of State under FDR in charge of visa. He kept hundreds of thousands of Jews out of America and sent them ultimately to their death in the Holocaust. And FDR didn't know what he was doing. I think the administration is full of anti-Israel people who don't think Hamas is evil. I have a hard time. I just think they're stupid. They're ignorant. I won't say stupid. They're ignorant of the reality of what's going on in Israel. Do you agree with me that there are Breckinridge Longs who are leaking and who are trying Joe Biden not helping himself, but is there a Breckenridge Long problem going on here?
I think it's more of a problem among the junior and mid-level officials. I mean, it's so outrageous, Hugh. All these no-name mid-level officials in the administration sign or anonymously sign. I don't even know what that means. Anonymously sign a petition criticizing President Biden's policy on Israel. Who are these people, by the way? What? Like, I worked in government. You know, you don't like your boss's policy, you resign.
You quit.
And you're on with it. You work for them. He doesn't work for you. And you don't get to weigh in. You make your case internally. You make your case behind closed doors. If you don't like the ultimate policy, you leave. And that they want their jobs. It's also like a metaphor for this generation that's entitlement, that they get to criticize the boss publicly but keep their job. It's so crazy. I think his more senior level advisors, some of whom I know Jake Sullivan, I know Tony Blinken, I don't know Lloyd Austin, but I know Blinken and Sullivan. I don't think they are of the view that you're articulating. I think many of these advisors hate Netanyahu. They personally resent Netanyahu, and I think it's foolish. You can have disagreements or criticisms of Netanyahu, but again, as I said earlier, on the policy that matters, which is what Israel is going to do against Hamas, Netanyahu is representing where his country is at, and it is a broad consensus. So you can hate the man, but and go ahead and have at it, but don't do what Chuck Schumer did yesterday and say the man's got to go. And hope that you're going to get a different policy.
Dan, we're going to disagree because I know they hate Netanyahu, but I think they are morally fuzzy. And I think the problem is postmodern America's inability to articulate that there is evil. There are only two problems in the world, evil and suffering. Suffering is not always accompanied by evil, but evil is always accompanied by suffering. I don't think they understand Sinwar. I really don't. Do you think they understand that a monster can be in charge of Gaza?
I think they understand Sinwar. I think they have this fantasy that it is easy to put in place a post-Sinwar Palestinian polity and society that is healthy after several generations of Palestinians being indoctrinated by Sinwar and his predecessors that the Jews can be driven out of the Middle East. I think that's the mistake.
But the first step is the complete and utter defeat of Hamas. If you want to turn it into a Superfund site and rebuild Gaza, and I want to do that, it could be Lebanon in 1950. It could be Beirut. But first,
But we can't do it alone. You have to defeat Hamas. You got to get rid of Sinwar and Dave and the others in the leadership, and then you got to say to the Palestinians, "Okay, guys, it takes two to tango. We can flood Gaza with money. We can say we're committed. If there's not, you have agency." To the Palestinian people, you have agency here. Who's going to step up and work with us in doing this? We cannot do this alone.
Okay, we've got 1 minute. I have not seen one leader. I know UAE is working, Saudi Arabia is working with us, and I know the Qataris are doing their job, which is they're obliged to do this, and they've threatened to throw Hamas out. The new government from the PA, any hope there, Dan? I don't follow it close enough. Anybody new? Anyone show up that you might have confidence in being a...
I think the PA is totally corrupt. By the way, most leaders in the Persian Gulf I talk to say the PA is totally corrupt. Abu Mazen needs to go. If you look at the textbooks in the schools in the West Bank, they are still celebrating the slaughtering of Jews.
You see, they need someone.
They'll name streets after terrorists that kill Jews.
They need a McSisai, they need a Yoshida, they need an Adenauer, they need somebody. And you're saying there ain't anybody yet. Dan Senor, we are out of time.
If they are, they get driven out.
Or killed. I want to thank you. I want everyone who's listening to go right now over to Call Me Back. Just to Call Me Back, Dan Senor, S-E-N-O-R. Go get his two books, by the way, if you want to know what's going on in the ground in Israel. The Genius of Israel, The Surprising Resilience of a Divided Nation, as well as Startup Nation, along with his brother-in-law, Saul Singer. Great books. Dan Senor, you have been my tutor in this, and I appreciate your introducing me to people like Aviv and all the rest of the stars of Call Me Back Pod. If there are podcast awards, the Oscar for Best Podcast in 2023 would go to Dan Senor. Thank you, Dan.
Hugh, thank you, sir. As always, appreciate it.
A great pleasure.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.